This is Dan Nexen. Welcome to the first New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy podcast of 2013. This episode features one of my favorite contemporary fantasy writers, Felix Gilman. Felix is the author of Thunderer, Gears of the City, and The Half-Made World. The sequel to The Half-Made World, The Rise of Ransom City, was published in November 2012 and is the subject of our discussion. I hope you enjoy. Hi, this is Dan Nexen, and I'm speaking to Felix Gilman. Felix, are you there?
I'm there. Hi.
Thank you so much for agreeing to do this recording today.
No problem. I'm happy to be here.
So I'm always curious about authors themselves, which is why I always begin by asking them to tell us a bit about themselves, and I'm going to ask you the same thing.
I never quite know how to answer that question.
Why don't I be a little bit more, I'll press you then. Let's start with, how did you get into writing?
I was one of those children who was a bookish child, which is not surprising. And I used to spend a lot of time as a child sort of writing stories of various kinds, and I would, if I read something I liked, I would write great long unreadable pastiches of it, and I had notebooks of stuff that I wrote in, and I used to, the statute of limitations has expired, so I can say that when I was a very small child, I used to have a big pile of those nice little sort of notebook things that I nicked from school and wrote in. And I don't have any of that stuff anymore because it was all thrown out. So I used to do that a lot as a child, and then I suppose I stopped writing for a long time as a young adult, but I always thought of it as something that I wanted to do, something that I would do. Sooner or later, I would buckle down and write a book. And I started various things, and some of which sort of worked out better than others, but none of which ever really got finished. And I had back in 2006, I had a period where I had some time between jobs, and I had a job in the future in a few months that was fixed, and I had no job currently, and I had some savings, and it was a time when I could not possibly have been in a better position to actually sit down and write something if I was ever going to write something and stop talking about it, and no possible excuse for not actually buckling down and doing it. So I did, and I wrote in a few months what turned into the first draft of my first book, Thunderer, though it went through many significant subsequent iterations and revisions, but that was that was when I sat down and actually wrote something, and I did so just with a sort of really with the attitude that this was I would just see what happened. I would sit down and see if I actually was capable of the whatever it is that is required to sit down and start writing something that you know is still going to be there uncompleted 400 pages later, and that you have to keep churning through for a very long time, which is something that's on my mind right now because I've just finished a draft of a thing, and I've just handed that final draft to my editor, and I'm now sitting down thinking about starting the next thing. And I have an outline, but I'm now trying to push myself to get back over the resistance to actually sitting down and writing the first page with that awful knowledge that you've got all those hundreds of empty pages sitting in front of you. And it is every time an act of will. So that was how I started. I started writing, and that first book ended up getting published, and then the subsequent books were also published.
Let's get into the meat of your books in a few minutes, but I am curious. You are a transatlantic transplant, is that correct?
That's correct. I've lived in the States for a long time now. Since 98, I think. So I've lived here for a very long time. And I moved here, a couple of years after graduating university. My wife is a New Yorker, so I've lived in, I've lived in New York and in Boston and DC and various places.
So I know from earlier pre-conversations that you are not a full-time writer, that you also hold down a day job, and I can't imagine how difficult that must be to, on the one hand, work in a non-authorial professional context, but also then to produce these very dense, thoughtful books that you do.
Thank you. And yes, it is difficult. What's actually difficult is not so much the writing, because I write quickly, and I can find time to do the writing because it exercises a different part of the brain from real world day job work. What is tremendously difficult is it's all the ancillary stuff. Everybody says if you're a writer these days, you have to expect to promote your work yourself. And it is, of course, completely true. And that sort of all those other little tasks that go along with it, those little tasks use the same part of the brain as one's actual job.
So when you mean things like the kind of self-promotion that's become expected of authors, like maintaining a website, possibly having a blog, being on Twitter.
Yeah, well, I can do Twitter because that also uses a different part of the brain. Mm-hmm. But trying to maintain regular blog output is impossible. And trying to do things like, you may have noticed, anybody can see that I have not updated my blog in 6 months, and prior to that, I think I let it sit for about a year. And the website needs work. It's that sort of thing. It's the talking to people about sort of trying to get reviews and blurbs and things, which is difficult to do. It's difficult to do for everybody. I think day job or otherwise, it is difficult to do because most authors are, by their nature, sedentary shut-ins. Writing a book selects very heavily for wanting to sit in the room not talking to anybody for 6 hours at a time. That's not necessarily the best skill for writing yourself, so...
Yeah, it's funny. The more people I talk to, the more I feel like there's a kind of kinship between the academic lifestyle and the writing lifestyle, except for that we get a steady salary for doing what we're doing. So I do want to ask you before we get into the meat of things, why fantastic fiction? Was that just sort of always your love of what you wanted to do, and so when you always thought about being a writer, it was always going to be fantastic fiction, or is there a particular draw for you of writing in imaginary worlds or with major counterfactuals or things that make your writing, your worlds, your novels, weird and different from, say, quote-unquote, literary fiction?
On one level, the answer to that is just when I started writing the first book, that was what came out, and that really was on some level a very sort of experimental, let's see what happens sort of a thing. I think I've sort of been playing catch up ever since. On another level, I like fantastic or strange fiction. I like a lot of fiction that sort of that blurs the lines between the literary and the fantastic. I'm not a huge reader of squarely, centrally core genre fantastic fiction, though you know, I like Tolkien.
Well, that blurring of the line really does, I think, describe and animate, as I read it, a lot of your work. Your first series, as you mentioned, began with Thunderer, and that was a duology with Gears of the City as the second book. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And in Thunderer, it seems, well, I was sort of thinking back as I was preparing for the interview, and it seems like there's a really strong connection in some respects between works like Thunderer and the work we're going to talk about today, The Rise of Ransom City, insofar as these are all works that express a preference for shifting and uncertain worlds, where place is really a crucial character in the story. Is that a kind of idiom you like to play with? It just sort of happen that way?
No, that's definitely. I like uncertainty. I like strangeness. I like the fantastic in the sense of what feels genuinely fantastic or strange, which has to have an element of uncertainty, of surprise, of not being on top of it, of not quite knowing how it works or why. Otherwise, it doesn't really feel it doesn't feel magical or fantastic or weird. So I like that. On some level, I just think it's realistic. My actual lived experience of the world is that it's full of things that I don't understand and that don't make sense to me, and that I only have tiny partial glimpses of. I'm a well-informed person who reads the newspapers, and yet I don't actually know what's going on most of the time, or I think I know what's going on, but I don't. I absorb some piece of received wisdom that is not actually accurate. If the experience of blundering through a world filled with strange and unreasonable and arbitrary structures or apparent facts or monsters is sort of, as I say, on some level, I think, realistic.
And that's a really terrific description of a lot of the experience of reading the Half-Made World series. Now, as we've already kind of mentioned, The Rise of Ransom City is the second in that series. What do readers need to know about the Half-Made World in order to make sense of anything that we're going to talk about for the rest of the interview?
I hope readers can pick up Ransom City without having read The Half-Made World. I think that is true.
Thought I wasn't queer. I was thinking of Half-Made World as the series itself, not as the first novel.
So they're both set in a world that is it's sort of the frontier It's sort of mostly the American frontier of the 19th century, early 20th. It's not our world. It's not remotely our world. It's a secondary world created out of tropes and factoids and themes and little bits of junk from our ideas about the frontier, or the manifest destiny expansion of, let's say, you know, but it's not, it's not our world. And the, there's a central conflict, that is the, one of the central conflicts in the world is this sort of vast ongoing war that is sometimes an ideological thing and sometimes a blowing things up thing, between the line, which is a supernatural reification of industrialization, modernization, authority, the consumption of resources and the stamping of authority on the wilderness, and also takes the form of big monster demon trains. And the gun is the adversary of that, and it's a lawlessness, the myth of the gunslinger.
So you have the gun, which is which, as you say, is the embodiment of lawlessness, of the myth of the gunslinger, of the anti-hero who challenges authority at every turn. And the gun works through agents who literally have guns, who are inhabited by these demons, right?
Yeah.
And the line, as you said, is the forces of modernization, rationalization, and they're emblematic. Their emblematic thing are the engines, who are themselves also inhabited by the demons who control the line, and they've been fighting a war across this frontier for how long?
Since long ago, I can't remember my timeline at this point.
Then, of course, none of the characters can remember either. It's always been going on, as far as they're concerned.
Yeah, there is a timeline,
mm-hmm.
And it's been going on for a couple hundred years, and somewhere in across the books, I think there's enough information to indicate the actual timeline, in sort of snippets of stuff, but I can't remember it. I have a chronology somewhere that I try to work out to make it all more or less make consistent sense, but some things I like to make consistent sense, and some things I don't.
And one of the sources, one of the things that's ambiguous throughout the books, is that the characters routinely, in various ways, or come back to the theme that, you know, did the demons come, thus causing the war between the line and the gun, or are the demons something that humans made themselves? Which obviously works to kind of, at this level of kind of fantastic ambiguity, but also seems to function as a metaphor for the ways in which social forces, which we create, have this character that we lose control, that individuals lose control over them, and become subject to them. And I assume that was a deliberate move on your part.
Yeah, that's absolutely deliberate. Yes, and we. It is, as you say, ambiguous exactly how all of this got started, but it's certainly clear that to whatever extent people were involved at the start, these things have become social facts that are just now out there, outside of anybody's control, and that you just have to deal with.
and one of the things that happens recurrently in various shapes and forms throughout the books are efforts by individuals on the frontier where this war is being worked out to carve out separate space or neutral space or alternative space, which is not often not dominated by demons, but by sort of individual or collective self-determination of humanity. And one of the major examples of this that drives some of the narrative is the Red Valley Republic. So I thought you might tell us a little bit about that.
Right. That is at the start of the first book, The Half-Made World, the Red Valley Republic is it's the previous generation's failed attempt to establish a democratic union of sorts, or at least a sort of a mercantile union. But it was our characters. The preceding generation for the people of the Half-Made World, it was their grand old cause, their great failed something. And it originates in a mercantile accord between a bunch of small states. This is a fragmented frontier in which there are all sorts of different kinds of political groupings and little states and little quasi-feudal states alongside other stuff. And this was an attempt to carve out some sort of union there, and it falls apart. And how it fell apart and what their secret weapon might have been is part of the MacGuffin that gets the plot of the first book going. But they are sort of constructed out of elements of the Revolutionary War and the Civil War, and bits of the myths of both and feelings about both are attached to them. Yes, they have a set of that they're very concerned with modern democratic principles and principles of republican virtue. And how one can construct a functioning, virtuous state, a virtuous republican state, and a republican not in the Romney sense, but in the
political theoretic sense of Machiavelli and all of that crowd.
Yeah. So they have, they were defeated and scattered 25 years before anything starts in the book, but remnants of that appear on the frontier, and they've gone a bit weird in their generation in the wilderness.
You give us a strong sense that on the one hand, you know, they have these principles that are kind of frontier republicanism, individualism, small d democracy, but they're kind of blowhards about it too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing that, you know, we only see in the book directly the what's left 25 years after they were beaten. So I think it's an open question that, you know, that I don't know the answer to what it was like in its heyday. What we see 25 years later is blowhards, or people who have started to adopt to adopt their parents' generation's tradition as holy writ. And it started to make them get a little bit weird.
One of the things that you mentioned earlier that's wonderfully disorienting about the Red Valley Republic, and thematically this extends throughout the entire way in which you've cobbled the world from the flotsam and jetsam of our own, is the way in which the Red Valley Republic, you know, gives you the myth of the lost cause. It gives you that key element in the traditional Western of these soldiers who fought for an ideal who are now stranded out on the West. On the other hand, that ideal, despite the kind of blowhardiness that we've talked about, you know, has more elements of the American Revolution, right? They are an anti-slavery grouping. They aren't a perfect mirror of the Confederacy. And that whole kind of way in which you take the elements of the traditional Western, but mix them up in novel configurations, and just enough so we can say, aha, these are the key mythological elements of the Western genre, but they're not the way we expected. I thought that was really powerful and really cool.
Thank you. I mean, yes, that's throughout the books. I'm constantly trying to, as you say, take bolt bits of this stuff together in odd and surprising ways that makes it a little bit unclear how you're supposed to feel about parts of this, and reflect, you know, in the half-made world, and in particular in Ransom City, you've got characters who are centrally concerned with fashioning identities for themselves by picking up little bits of mythic flotsam and jetsam. Everyone is engaged in that same pursuit of trying to make sense of this rather confusing world that they're in by picking up scraps of stuff that they sort of recognize and fashioning it into an idea of the world.
So just to keep score, we have the line who is fighting the gun. We have the remnants of the Red Valley Republic, and their remnants are almost more important as myth and cause than as any discrete individuals. But you also have this group of people floating around, the First Folk, who, you know, are sort of, on the one hand, kind of like the stand-in for Native Americans or Aboriginals, but on the other hand, they're really not. They're very strange. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Sure. So they are the people who were there first. And you can't have a frontier story without the people who were there first. Or you can have a frontier story, but it's not one that really reflects our world at all. They are in no respect very similar to actually existing Native Americans of any kind. And maybe a tiny little bit reminiscent of Australian Aboriginal cultures, but only the tiniest little bit, and only by accident. They are the first people, the displaced people, but they don't correspond to any actually existing displaced culture, which was we one of the reasons for that is that we don't see them themselves through their own eyes very much at all. We see them through the eyes of the other characters who are all one way or another the part of the expanding, whatever you would call it, culture. And the word is escaping me. Because colonial is not the right word.
Well, I mean, they are engaged in colonialism. I mean, this is one of the things that people, that we kind of mask about the American expansion, is that it's a colonial process of plopping down little cities or little towns or little economic communities, and then slowly or sometimes more rapidly displacing, killing, corralling, controlling the indigenous population. So I think it's fine to say that this is a colonial enterprise.
Yeah, you're right. I was thinking there was some nuance in the word colonial that was not quite right, but I can't actually articulate what I feel that nuance is.
Well,
so I'm probably imagining it.
Well, maybe, I mean, that is, one thing to note about the Western migration, or no, it's not even Western, I'm not sure, the migration into the half-made world is that it's not centrally directed. This is not a state enterprise, at least as you present it. So maybe that's it?
Yes, that's part of it. Though, none of this made it into the final box. Okay, never mind. I had some stuff that I was trying to use somewhere. And if there's ever a third book, I probably will, about the initial expansion, in which it is indeed state directed, and the ways in which it was state directed. And I think probably none of that made it anywhere into the final book.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's not helpful. But that was how I was thinking about it.
So we have the first folk who are kind of this literalization of all the different kinds of Western imaginary of indigenous peoples. But then we have some actual characters who matter a great deal. And in the first book, they are Liv, whose last name I had written down, but I can't find Alther. What is Liv's last name?
Alverheisen,
who is a psychologist who's come from the old world. And then John Creedmoor, who is a really wonderful character, an agent of the gun.
Who is in fact also from the old world, but longer ago.
Because of course he's very old.
He's old. He's in his 50s, I think, which is old for a professional gunman. So he is, as you say, an agent of the gun. He is a would-be retired at the beginning. A gunslinger type, a fast talking gunslinger, and somebody who has spent his life and spent his youth trying on various glamorous causes of various kinds, and ends up fashioning himself into an iconic fast-talking, gun-wielding, Wild West crook type, but also because he's part of this cause of the gun, he gets called into service, and then he and Liv cross paths, not very happily. Get caught up together in this business of hidden something that involves a general who is the military genius, the George Washington of the Republic, and who is now very, very old, also mad or damaged.
So they are the chief characters of the first book, but the second book actually focuses on Harry Ransom, a very different character. Why don't you tell us a little bit about him?
Right. So Harry Ransom is he's a salesman. He's a businessman. He's a would-be rags to riches story. He's a a kid from a crappy little town who has maybe, possibly invented a wonderful free energy machine. And he's, when the book starts, he's touring around the small towns of the frontier trying to drum up investment and interest and enthusiasm for his wonderful invention. And he's a kid, and this is where he's going to really start his brilliant, glittering fortune. He's on the one hand, he wants to be a hero. He wants to be a great and wonderful person who will bring this fantastic gift to the world, because he's a wonderful genius. He's an idealist and an utopian. On the other hand, he wants to get rich. He wants to be powerful. He wants to. He's got a head full of business propaganda, stories about rich men making their fortunes in the big cities. And so he's out there getting into adventures and trouble and blowing things up. And he this is not really a spoiler since it happens in the first 15 pages or so, but he crosses paths with Logan Creedmoor, and we see what's happened to them since the events of the first book, and who's chasing them and what's happening, and because of that he ends up being caught up in politics, and that sends his ambitions off kilter, and he gets caught up in the great events of the war, and ends up, I don't say where he ends up.
So one of the wonderful things about this I should mention is that, so he's, as you say, driven by this kind of Horatio Alger memoir, memoir literature. He's read it and vibed and taken way too seriously. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, what we're reading is his memoir of a kind of rags to riches and back to rags kind of storyline. So there's this great, as I think runs through the novel on so many levels, this great interplay or layering of themes. But I think for
trying to tell something too. So it's told in the form of a memoir, but it's not just a memoir. He is, again, he says this in the first few pages. So this is not a spoiler. He, after everything that's happened to him and everything that he's trying to tell the story of and to sort of to tell the great events of history that he's been involved in his way. He is heading out west, and he's gathered a bunch of people with him, and he's trying to gather more, and he's sending off these dispatches as he goes, and he wants to found a utopian something or other out there. And so he is, even as he goes, and as he's trying to tell the story and to set everything straight, he is, as I... different readers have had different views on how untrustworthy he is, and I think that it is open to debate how untrustworthy he's supposed to be, but for what the view of the author is worth, my view is that he's genuinely trying to be reasonably honest about what's going on, and he is reasonably trustworthy. But he's also trying to sell his vision of the future, and so it is a. And as you say, his memoir and the way he's trying to sell things is a mirror of the memoir that he grew up reading, which is a form of. Well, it turns out to be. Not just metaphorically a form of propaganda, but actually literally a form of propaganda. But I won't say any more about that.
So one of the things that I think, so those of us who read very avidly The Half-Made World and waited for the rise of Ransom City may find it disturbing to have wanted to know so much more from the perspective of Liv and from Creedmoor, only to have a massive change in narrative perspective. You know, although we do find out essential information about them, it was a shock. And I'm wondering why you decided to tell somebody else's story.
So one answer to that is I didn't want to write a middle book of a trilogy. And I sat down and tried to do the story of Liv and Creedmoor following on from what happened in the first book, and my heart was not in it. And I don't think it would have been an interesting book. The book that sort of just picks up and moves them on, it wasn't working. And part of that is because as I say, I like I find it most interesting when the characters are not 100% on top of what's going on. And if you've got a great big world-saving war-ending plot, which, you know, which there is, the Liv and Creedmoor become caught up in the half-mode world and then is moving forward. In the background and sort of threaded through the action of the second book. To write a direct sequel would have put all the focus on the core of what's happening so that we see it directly and we don't have any question about it, and we know that we are unambiguously at the center of what's actually going on in the world and in charge of it. And I cannot, that doesn't interest me. So what happens in the second book is since we see it through Harry Ransom's perspective, we are not directly at the center of those events, I wanted to shift things to a more personal story. Which, you know, gets involved in the grand stuff of the war and politics and glory, but is ultimately more about one individual's rise and fall, with the grand stuff in the background happening, but we are not. We don't have that illusion of being in control. That's a somewhat rambling answer, but I think that was why the shift in perspective. And having shifted to Harry Ransom's perspective, which, as I say, was sort of it was an iterative process. I started with a draft that was much more following directly on with Ransom introduced as a minor character. And over the course of revisions, some stuff moved into the background and some stuff moved into the foreground. And once I hit a tipping point and Ransom moved sufficiently into the foreground, it made sense to write in his voice. So it's in his first person memoir voice. I hate it when authors talk about characters taking control. That does not happen, but it does happen that when you go through a bunch of revisions, you find that some things work and some things don't.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because as I mentioned, you know, my initial response was as I got more into it, I really felt, you know, very strongly that at the end of the day, this was the way to tell the story, and that it wouldn't have worked any other way. And what you say dovetails nicely with my sense of that, because I, on the one hand, you know, if you followed Liv and Creedmoor, they couldn't pass into the kind of legendary status that's so essential to the entire workings of the novel, right? What you talk about is the kind of uncertainty, the way in which sort of knowledge appears and slips away, and that collective memory and even forgetting plays such a key role in the way that this world works, and as you suggest, the way that our world works. But secondly, because it really subverts the standards of kind of the high fantasy quest, right, or journey that in many ways, you know, the whole books are riffing on, but in a Western setting. So, you know, to show us that there are other journeys going on, some of which, like Harry's, might be incredibly important to what happens in the world, even though they have a very limited perspective on it, many of which are probably, you know, not consequential to the workings of history, but are just as important, at least for the individual to experience them. I thought that was really cool. I thought it was really neat, and I thought that it was one way in which the book, you know, is more than just a Western with fantastic elements or a fantasy set on a Western frontier.
Yeah, no, that is also part of why I wanted to shift the perspective. On some level, had it stuck directly with Liv and Creedmoor, the structure of a straightforward quest fantasy took over. I mean, you know, in the version that I was thinking of where it was then, it becomes a straightforward quest fantasy with a tiny little bit of Western trapping. Because there's really only one way of telling that story, and you know, Tolkien did it well. I like the Two Towers and the Return of the King. I really enjoyed them, and nobody needs to do it again. And I can't do it better. So this was different, and as I said, this was how it worked. I beg readers' indulgence for the change of perspective, but I'm optimistic that people will be okay with it.
I mean, this novel has been called, or at least the first novel, a steampunk fantasy. And I know in some of our pre-conversations, we mulled that over a bit and talked a little bit about steampunk. I'm not sure how much I want to push you on that. But I do want to ask you about something that's been kind of gnawing at me, and I can't quite articulate it, which is that it seems to me that there's something really interesting about creating a fantasy out of the elements of the Western imaginary rather than, and I don't mean West versus East, but, you know, the wild Western imaginary versus the standard high fantasy setting of swords and sorcery. And I know that not only are there precursors to doing this, but also there are more people who are now choosing to situate fantasy writing in the imaginary 19th century and the American imaginary 19th century of the West. But unlike, I think, a lot of quote unquote steampunk fantasy, this is not a technology driven story. Well, that's an awful way of putting it. This is a story which fundamentally owes its sensibility to fantastic literature, understood in the kind of high fantasy idiom, right? The enchanted world, et cetera, et cetera. And I can't quite articulate it, but it must be sort of both challenging and liberating, and also really say something about what fantasy is to create this kind of a locale, this kind of a story. And I was wondering whether you've had any thoughts about what it means or what it does to fantasy to locate it in this kind of a setting.
And one thing that that I think it can do, that I hope it can do, is to shift the focus of the fantasy from the idea of a the lost world, the medieval world in decline, to thinking about a world that sees itself as on the cusp of the future, building future, British progress towards whatever, and I think that's interesting to write about. I like that sense of anything is possible. There are these roads that the future could go down, and I think it helps us. I don't make any grand political claims for fantastic fiction generally, and it sort of grates on me a little bit when people talk about these things as though the justification for fiction has to be coming up with a rather improbable way in which it has some sort of political impact, because it doesn't, and nobody reads books anyway. The potential political impact that you might have through your story is essentially zero, because...
I gotta interrupt you here.
It's a weird niche habit.
I disagree. I think that if I think about most of my political beliefs, I think they were profoundly shaped by the novels, some of which were fantasy, that I read in my teens, for example. So I'm not sure that's right. The impact may not be, you know, a political manifesto that drives a movement, but I do think that fantastic literature shapes the imaginary of many people in ways that has political ramifications for much of their life. But
that may be true. I don't know.
But that aside, I'm sorry because I interrupted your train of thought.
It's an interesting question. I was pausing to think about where my own. I don't think my political views are that heavily shaped by fiction. I genuinely don't. I think my political views are much more shaped by either non-fiction reading or primarily by the sort of people who I know and talk to, and my sense of where tribally I fall in existing political groups. But that is an aside, because I'm looking around the stuff that I read as a teenager, and you know, I like a lot of Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, and I don't feel that it really influenced me politically. I mentioned C.S. Lewis because I feel a big fan of C.S. Lewis books. But anyway.
Well, quite politically different, I think, than your own views.
and I love C.S. Lewis, and I've got a pile of books here because the thing that I've just handed in is in some ways a homage to the C.S. Lewis Out of the Silent Planet, etc. books, which I love but don't agree with.
Well, but I'm thinking about, so I mean, I found the Prydain Chronicles very influential in terms of my basic moral compass, and particularly Tarin Wanderer. And I do think that for some subset of people who probably never read about the Industrial Revolution, right, or never read any of the political literature that focused on what to make of the social dislocations of the coming of modernity, whether that be Marx or in a kind of earlier form Smith or Karl Polanyi, you know, this is their entry into a kind of set of political claims about what rationalization, industrialization, might the production of new class relations, the ways in which people become serviced to economic systems and to industry itself. This is a kind, you know, the books like this are a kind of entry into thinking about that. Or thinking about, you know, what does it mean to romanticize the lone gunman? Is that really a kind of romanticization that's sustainable or healthy? And these books really do grapple with those kinds of questions.
It's not impossible that a young person might have that these books or any books might influence somebody's political thinking. I just if that happens, I think it happens in unpredictable ways, and you never know what people are going to take away. I often get the sense a lot of the political conversation around steampunk and what steampunk politically has to say, this is probably a more complicated digression than we possibly have time for.
Well, if we do have time, it's not really a digression, I think, so I'd like you to pursue it.
But part of my skepticism is that I think there's a lot of the sort of fiction that talks about the 19th century and that gets heavily into how awful factories in the 19th century were and the awfulness of class relations in the 19th century and the terribleness of colonialism. I never know whether readers come away from that sort of thing or whether people are talking about this come away from that sort of thing with a sense of having been on some level sort of radicalized, thinking, oh, you know, these are bad things, or whether the lesson that people come away with is, things sure were bad 100 years ago. Our great-grandfathers sucked. I'm glad we're better people now and everything's fine. And then they go away and they type that on their computers that are made out of conflict materials. To the extent, and that is something that I worry about when writing anything that is sort of set in the 19th century. You know, when I express skepticism about the political impact of the fiction, I'm sort of taking the piss out of myself, because one sits there worrying about this sort of thing, but on some level it seems tremendously narcissistic to sit there at one's desk as one makes up these stories, worrying about what you are teaching an imaginary 15-year-old. I think we have, in the community, so to speak, I think there's often an inflated sense of the power of this sort of writing. I'm skeptical, but on the other hand, stuff isn't worth thinking about. But as I say, I do think it's unpredictable. In the event that you have any kind of influence, it's very unpredictable what kind of influence one has, and readers read things against the grain and come away with different senses of what you're trying to say. Unless you're terribly literal about what you're saying, in which case readers are just as likely to say, go away. So I don't know.
Obviously, you know, what you are saying is a case against didacticism, right? But it's not, I think, a case against thinking about the politics of a particular constructed world, or thinking about the possible political implications of telling a story. And to me, I just don't think you can get away with it, right? Because you've written novels, and this series, you know, as well as your prior one, but this series, you know, is a novel that sets out to dislocate, you know, very fundamental themes in not just American identity, but the identity of the modern West. And it does so in a way which maintains constant ambivalence, which to me is sort of what I wanted to kind of push you for, and you've already alluded to, you know, which I think sets it apart from a lot of the attempts to work with the politics of the 19th century in a number of the very large number of books that are now tackling or setting things in the 19th century.
Oh, no, I agree, and I think you've got to... No, I mean, if you're writing anything that touches on anything political and essentially anything that you might be writing does, it's important to making the book work, and that's important even if nobody's ever going to see it. Otherwise, we might as well not bother. I think we got off on this discussion about whether this it is realistic to think in terms of this actually impacting people, which I'm not sure whether it does. But I do think it's important to think about it, because that's the book that you're writing.
So,
I'm surprised when anybody reads anything at all. So.
Well, I mean, regardless of the question of impact, though, there is this sort of question we started out with, which is, you know, what does it mean to set fantasy not in the ancien regime, but in the period of the emergence of modernity? And what does it mean to explicitly, you know, turn social facts into magical, demonic forces? And what does it mean to try to transport a set of genre expectations about what fantasy is into a realm that, you know, isn't the foundational realm for those tropes? And I think that these books just are wonderful at working through those kinds of themes, even if at the end of the day, and maybe it's all for the best, you know, it kind of leaves an engaged reader thinking, I'm not quite sure what to make of this.
Right. Not very much. I mean, I'm thinking about fantasy, and I don't want to single anyone out, but I mean, most fantasy that is nominally set in the Middle Ages is in fact really set in the 19th century, anyway. So.
Well, that's really interesting. Can you elaborate on that? Because I've never heard that before. Maybe it's more common than I realized. But
just the well, I'm thinking here of your classic standard big fat fantasy or your fantasy video game where everything is set in. You know, you assume that every city is big enough to support a thieves' guild.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is really Dickens. To the extent the world in which these people live, in which it appears that everybody has flush toilets, is not in fact the 1950s. It's a little bit of the 1950s. It's a little bit of, I'm not knocking it. It's fun. I enjoyed Skyrim, but. It's.
I wasted way too much time in Skyrim, but anyway, go.
It's terrifying. Well, because the awful thing is, you have to play it through Steam, and Steam tells you how many hours you've played.
I see. I have an Xbox, so.
Oh, you see, because on a PC you have to play it through Steam, and Steam every time you load it up tells you how many hours you've played.
Yeah.
And it's just it's the most unpleasant feature. I don't know why they do it. But anyway. But you know, but that world in which, you know. It's not really a medieval world. It's not really a medieval worldview, and you know, people are.
So it's set in the 19th. So when you say that all high fan, or not all, obviously, and now we have, you know, another realm of conscious pushback against high fantasy tropes.
Well,
when you say
it's not. Tolkien's not. Tolkien is the mental world of his characters is the mental world of, but it's a very foreign, very distant mental world. And if you're reading about characters who seem to be sort of recognizably quite a lot like you, you're not really reading about people living in anything that remotely resembles the 12th century or whenever it is that.
So when you say 19th century, you mean that, you know, you sort of have the scale of urbanization in the 19th century. You have still features of the wild, untamed march. And you also have characters who are hybrids, right, who have a kind of combination of the of being able to recognize the old look, the sort of old world, and see it as normal, but also have increasingly modern outlooks or outlooks that would be recognizably our own. Is that sort of what you're getting at?
Yeah, but I think that's what I'm getting at. Yeah.
But then when you make it explicit, all sorts of cool stuff happens, right? Because then you have, you know, all of a sudden, you know, your dragons are not steam. Your dragons are not stand-in for steam engines or gunboats or whatever. They are steam engines or gunboats or heavier-than-air machines or what have you. And your magic swords are not, blades that are enchanted. They're guns that are retrospectively a kind of magic because of their lethality and their ability to make an individual into a killing machine, much like the sort of hero of the high fantasy novels. So, you know, it just does really interesting things to that, to then take that, but now start to think really seriously in a way that these books do about what it means to really be on the cusp of modernity and the kinds of attitudes that produces and the kinds of both horrible things and wonderful things and things that are terrible in the classic sense because they are wonderful. So it's pretty awesome stuff.
Yeah, no, it's fun. I like, I think it is a fun place to set books. And I like the sense of the future.
Well, as listeners can tell, I think these books are great. They're some of the best books I've read in a long time, and I tend to say nice things about everybody I talk to, and I tend to like a lot, but I really, you know, when I agreed to do this gig, interviewing you was one of the things that I wanted to do, and I'm glad it's worked out, and I guess also, I hope it's not premature, there's going to be a book forum on Rise of Ransom City on Crooked Timber in the future, isn't there?
I think so.
Well, that should be...
I've heard that they're trying to organize it, and I don't know where things stand.
But... I've been trying to muscle my way onto it, so.
I hope so. It would be really cool if it happened, but I don't know.
So after I've done singing the praises of these books and telling you, you must go out and read these now, and even if you find them a bit odd and disconcerting, that's what makes them so terrific. I do want to ask you to come back to what you mentioned at the very beginning, which is that, and I hope this didn't make talking about these books difficult for you. You have a new book that's finished. And maybe you could give us a taste of what that's about.
Yes, it is. It's set in something which is more or less the real world. It is again 19th century. It starts among 19th century occultists and sitting around meditating their way through the planets, and it straight up lifts a scene from a wonderful book, a history by Alex Owens, called The Place of Enchantment, which has a discussion of the overlap between astronomical excitement about astronomy and excitement about Mars and excitement among the fashionable set over the occult and telepathy and etc. And it starts from there, and it is a kind of magical travel to Mars book, which is why I got a big pile of C.S. Lewis stuff on my desk, and also Olaf Stapledon and etc. I'm pleased with it, I think. I think it's fun and weird.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to it, and I want to thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you. Thank you. This was fun.
And hope we can do it again sometime.
I hope so.
Right. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
You've come to the end of another episode of New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy. This podcast, featuring Felix Gilman, was recorded on 17 October 2012. Thanks for listening. So long.